welcome in. Happy Thursday, Lloyd. Friday, good morning.
Eve. Friday Eve.
Friday
good morning.
Eve.
Good morning.
It's not. I don't think it's going to be quite as hot today.
But it will be smoky.
But it is smoky out there. You know, it was funny. I was watching some of the reports out of northern Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And there was ash falling in northern
yes.
Michigan yesterday.
Yes.
People were talking about the ash falling on. I mean, I saw one video. It looked like it was snowing.
Wow.
I mean, it very small snowflakes, but it looked like it was snowing.
We got some rain yesterday in Southfield. You know, we had a little downpour for maybe about 5 minutes, and then, you know, went, you know, it was cleared up. And
the
then,
old Florida rain.
Yeah, exactly. And so then I said, okay, well, I'm take Sasha out for a walk. And I'm walking, and the sky was orange.
Yeah.
My neighborhood was orange. I'm like, what? And
yeah.
You get some, and I mean, and by the time I finished walking, I was coughing.
Yes.
So it is not a good day to be out, especially if you have asthma or COPD or any of those types of respiratory ailments. Mm-hmm. Please don't go out. And it looks like fog when you're driving, but it's smoke.
Yeah. I mean, I woke up at, you know, this morning,
yeah.
Got out of the house, and I'm like, why does it?
Like somebody's barbecuing.
Yeah, who's having a bonfire at 4:30 in the morning? This is crazy. But, yeah, this is that Canadian wildfire smoke. And
yeah.
we've had this for the last, I don't know, handful of years around this time where this smoke drifts in. I don't remember the smell being as pungent
no.
as it was today.
Yes.
I mean, Brian, when I got here this morning, he was like, if I can smell it, he's like, my nose stinks. And if I can smell it, you know it's bad.
It's bad.
I was up in the middle of the night last night. I forgot about this. I thought my house was on fire.
Yeah. You would think
oh
that.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I'm running. I ran down to the basement. I'm all over. I was like, what's burning? What's burning?
Yeah. No,
yeah.
You would think that.
Yeah. So if you don't, again, it's one of those things. If you don't have to be outside, it is advised
yeah.
that you don't.
Yep.
So just be cautious of that and mindful of that this morning. You know, the other part, too, is like, I remember a couple of years ago talking with like a wildlife expert
uh-huh.
on these things, and they don't, like, the Canadian government doesn't necessarily do a whole lot with these because there's so much land that naturally catches fire around this time.
Yeah.
These aren't man-made or anything like that. These are just things that happen in these vast stretches of wilderness up there. And for the most part, they let it, you know,
they let it run its course. Right.
But then we, you know, here we're dealing with.
And we got it. I think they have fires burning in Minnesota too. So we got Canada and Minnesota.
Yeah,
we're getting a double whammy. The nationwide outbreak of cyclosporiasis continues to grow. Michigan remaining one of the hardest hit states. More than 3,700 cases have now been reported across the U.S. and at least 44 people have been hospitalized. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services says its investigation points to lettuce and salad greens as the likely source, though a specific grower or supplier has still not been identified. Health officials recommend buying whole heads of lettuce instead of bagged salad mixes, discarding the outer leaves, thoroughly washing the inner leaves. Symptoms include severe watery diarrhea, stomach cramps, nausea, and low-grade fever, and can begin up to 2 weeks after exposure. And we're going to be talking to someone coming up at 6:19 from Wayne State University about how to best clean and prepare our fruits and vegetables to avoid this cyclospora bacteria.
Meanwhile, Steve Yzerman out as general manager of the Detroit Red
Wings. Were you surprised?
Surprised based on job performance? No.
Okay.
Surprised by the timing? Yes.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that I necessarily believe that he stepped down.
When I saw that, I said the same thing.
Here are the things that went through my head. So, okay, Yzerman got hired in 2019. Everybody was over the moon that Stevie was coming back.
Yeah.
And he had this, you know, this plan. It's a steady plan. We're going to get better and better. But when he got here, the organization was in rough shape.
It was.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the idea here was that you were just going to steadily add talent until you get to the point where you're ready. You're right there. You are, the cup is overfloweth. And you need to just drop that one ice cube in to let the water fall over the sides. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where we were headed. And it never materialized. It never materialized. The cup got about half full. And even when it looked like you had enough to drink, you tipped it over.
Over, yes.
And at the end of the seasons, they blew this the whatever lead they had, and they never made the playoffs.
No.
So it just felt like not a surprise. I was a little surprised that if it was going to happen, I thought it was going to happen closer towards when the season ended.
Okay.
And once we got further and further away, it was like, okay, this isn't going to happen.
Right, that's what I felt. Yeah.
He's got runway. He's got whatever their plan that he's talking about internally. Everybody's on board.
Yeah.
So we're just going to let it play out. And then Dylan Larkin requests a trade, and he wants out.
Yes.
And Steve Yzerman came out and was just like, look, he's under contract. And we're gonna work on a best deal for us, being the organization and what is best for us.
Yes.
Not just Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if that created some sort of turmoil, because Stevie will.
Oh, yeah.
As a general manager, he's got a track record of being a little petty when it comes to some of these trades.
Yes,
he'll hold on to these guys until it becomes advantageous for him.
That's right.
So I don't know if that played a role or not, but he is going to stay in the organization. He's going to be a special advisor to Chris Illich, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not leaving, but he is leaving the post, and now a search for a new general manager begins, and we'll talk with Helene St. James coming up at 6:49 on that.
Michigan environmental regulators have approved a key permit renewal for Enbridge's Great Lakes Tunnel project, clearing another hurdle for a proposed replacement of the aging Line 5 oil pipelines beneath the Straits of Mackinac. The $800 million project would place a new pipeline inside a concrete line tunnel up to 250 feet below the lake bed. Supporters say the tunnel would reduce the risk of anchor strikes and potential spills, while environmental groups and several Native American tribes argue it threatens the Great Lakes and tribal resources. Enbridge still needs federal approval and additional state permits before construction can begin.
Build the pipe.
And, you know, we were up there and we saw how it was going to be done. I mean, it is really fascinating what they're going to do and how they're going to put that together.
Yeah, the pipeline that's there now on the bed of the Strait is safe.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, a decade ago we had the anchor strike.
Anchor strike, yeah.
Okay, well, that was relatively handled pretty quickly. No major damage to the Strait, to the water, to anything around there. But again, you put it 250 feet below the bed.
Yeah.
That eliminates completely.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, build that thing.
A new WDIV Detroit News poll shows Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson holding a commanding lead in the Democratic race for governor among likely Democratic primary voters. Benson backed by nearly 72%, while Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson receives just under 12%. About 16% remain undecided. The poll also found Benson enjoys significantly higher name recognition, with nearly 89% of voters familiar with her compared to 49% for Swanson. The survey of 500 likely Democratic voters, primary voters, was conducted July 8th through the 11th, has a margin of error of plus or minus 4.4 percentage points. And it's my anniversary today. Happy anniversary, Marie.
Oh, happy anniversary.
4 years.
Very good.
I call it number four ever after.
Forever after. There you go. Love it. Coming up on the other side, how do you prepare your fruits and vegetables to avoid coming down with the parasite cyclosporiasis? It's next on JR Morning. All right. So as these cases of cyclospora continue to rise here in the state of Michigan, although yesterday's jump wasn't as drastic.
Wasn't as much. No.
It was, what, 400 cases?
Something like that, yeah.
So that's good news.
Yeah.
Maybe it's getting out there that people need to stop eating salad. Get on the pizza diet with the rest of us.
Oh, boy.
Although I still got it, so I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, right.
But there is the question of, like, well, how do you prepare your food then? How do you prepare your fruits and vegetables to make sure you don't get it? Because it sounds like it's more difficult than what most people think. It's not just like a quick rinse.
And you got to ask, you know, if you go out to restaurants, you got to ask if they're following protocol. Because I was in a restaurant yesterday, and a lady next to me at the bar was all into this salad.
Oh.
She was all in. And it had a lot of stuff going on. Yeah, so.
Diane Kress is the chair and associate professor of the Department of Nutrition and Food Science at Wayne State University and joins us this morning. Professor, it's good to have you. What do we need to keep mindful of when we're preparing lunch or dinner with some of our produce?
Thank you. Yeah, it's nice to be here. So I guess the shortest piece of advice is treat your produce the way you treat your other high-risk foods like raw chicken, right? So that's where we are right now. So clean your surfaces before you cook, wash your foods properly, and then wash your hands before you handle them and wash your hands after you handle them. Because like you said a minute ago, these guys are like Velcro. They stick in the food. It's really hard to get them off. So the only way to really kill them and ensure your food is safe is to cook it. But you can use some washing procedures to reduce your risk, right? So cooking is the best way. Washing is the next best way. And I can tell you how you should wash them if you'd like me to tell you that.
Sure. Go ahead.
So don't soak. Don't give your produce a bath, because sometimes people will soak in vinegar. That doesn't work for this. So what you need to do is run it under clean, cold water and rub, right? So scrub. Friction is your friend here, trying to get those little Velcro parasites off of your food. Sounds really gross. So you can't do that with berries and things like that. So for those, you know, this is the time to enjoy and eat those. You really need to cook them. So do things like make pies, preserve your food. So make jams and jellies, save them for later, eat them now. But cooking them is really the only way to prevent that, to prevent from getting sick.
Professor, I'm glad we have you on, because I've always, this is a question I wanted to know. When you talk about produce with peels, things like, you know, melons and avocados, yep, and oranges and bananas, and a lot of people think that, you know, about washing those, they say, you know, I don't eat the peel, so I don't need to wash them. Is that a mistake?
That is a mistake. So peeling does not make washing unnecessary. What you actually have to wash is the peel on the outside, because when you cut through, what you do is you take whatever's on the outside and you bring it right through the middle of the inside. So wash your peels just the way I told you to wash your other produce, and then wash your hands before touching the inside of the fruit that you're going to eat, and then eat and enjoy that fruit. But don't stop eating your fruit, right? Don't stop eating your vegetables. Don't go on the pizza diet, oh, which I just heard about a second ago. Yeah.
Professor, that was not the news I wanted to hear this morning. Thank
I
you.
I love pizza. Let's be clear.
Hey,
I know.
I get it.
We appreciate your time. Thank you so much. We'll talk again very soon.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you got it. That's Diane Kress at Wayne State University.
But I mean, no, I just want to know, because
she's in the Department of Nutrition. If she says don't go on the pizza diet, you got to probably listen.
Well, and you know, when I think about like melons and avocados and oranges and bananas, and you know, people say, well, you know, it's got to peel. I'm not eating the peel, so I don't need to wash that. No, you still need to wash those peels too.
Yeah, I mean, again, they've kind of narrowed it down to lettuce, which is
sure
at least more narrow than what we were dealing with last week.
Yeah.
It was just like, well,
It could be berries, could be cilantro, yeah, could be blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that's the good news. At least we've got a suspected culprit.
Yes.
Here in the lettuce. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is going to address the nation tonight, 9 o'clock. You'll hear it right here on WJR. According to Caroline Levitt, she told Axios, President Trump will deliver a major address to the nation on protecting the integrity of our elections. We encourage every American to watch the president's speech. And there have been reports that this will be focused on free and fair elections. The president said there's a very big announcement, really big news regarding the security of U.S. voting and the systems that we have in place. We don't know if he's going to talk about 2020 or not.
I would put
smart money on yes.
Yeah, I would have a feeling he would.
Yes.
If he's going to talk about all this other, you know, about safety and stuff, I'm sure 2020 will kind of be woven in some kind of way.
Yeah, and again, there hasn't been real great evidence that anybody's brought forward to show that there was widespread voter fraud.
Right.
Widespread voter fraud that would flip an election.
Exactly.
Right? You're going to get hiccups here and there.
There, sure.
It's the nature of having these types of elections mm-hmm. in such a big country. Mistakes are going to be made.
Sure.
Of course.
Sure.
But nothing concrete. And so it'll be interesting to see how they're going to handle this. The other question is how are networks going to deal with this?
Exactly.
Whether they are going to show this or not.
Right.
Now, I don't care what type of news organization you are.
Mm-hmm.
You run a presidential address to the nation.
Yes.
And on the other side, like they always do, they can run a fact check through, and they can have somebody sitting
and
in a desk and going,
room.
Well, this wasn't correct, and he embellished here, and this was a lie, and this was a lie.
But you carry it, though.
But I think you absolutely carry it.
But you carry it. Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how they do it.
Yeah.
And what they do. Because there was, even, again, right after the 2020 election, the president held a press conference or an address, and they were cutting away from it early.
Yeah.
Because of some of the claims that he was making.
Yeah.
So it just be interesting to see.
Well,
make sure you listen tonight here on WJR, 9 o'clock. No, we'll have that.
Because we'll have the entirety. But you just be ready, because if he starts talking about 2020 and all that, you may get some of those networks who may try to cut away.
Well, and to be fair, it's not just Donald Trump. There have been times during the Obama administration, there were times during the Bush administration where stations weren't covering these speeches. I think it's wrong still.
Absolutely.
I don't care if there is a
presidential
if there is a presidential address to the nation. You know, this will be in the East Room.
Uh-huh.
So it's not as it's not an Oval Office speech.
No.
But it's still the president of the United States talking to the nation.
Yeah.
So I hope they cover it. Well, I hope they do.
It's respect for the office.
Absolutely.
You know, no matter how you feel about him personally, it's the respect for the office.
Correct. Coming up on the other side, the first reported case of single port robotic valve repair happened. And how does this change the nature of heart surgeries going forward? Feels like we could be stepping into yet another new era.
Yes.
And that's very exciting. We'll talk about that coming up on the other side. Get you caught up on the headlines as well. It's JR Morning. So, unbelievable. The first documented case of single port robotic mitral valve repair. It sounds incredibly futuristic.
It does.
And when you look at how far we've come in medical advances, this is yet another example of what we are going to be seeing in the future, what will be more prevalent, and how it's going to change surgeries. It's how it's going to change the invasiveness
and robots
of surgery.
Are so involved with all types of surgery now.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Let's talk to Dr. Rakesh Suri, the Regional Director of Cardiac Surgery for Robotics and Innovation at Corewell Health. Doctor, good morning. It's great to have you.
Good morning, gentlemen. A pleasure to be here.
So you performed this surgery, this valve repair.
That's correct.
I want to know a little bit, before we get to how things went, I want to know, leading up to that procedure, what went into it? How many years of research and development and testing and trials did you go through in order to get to that point?
Well, 21 years to be exact.
Oh, that's it.
Wow.
Wow.
And you know, doctor, many people still picture open heart surgery as, like, you know, cracking open the chest, spending weeks or maybe months in recovery, you know, and recovering. How different is this procedure from what most people imagine?
So that's a really important point. Most people come to me and are afraid, even though they are aware of the fact that they have a life-threatening problem in their chest. They say, I know I'm going to die, doctor, but I don't want my chest split. And that's really not the case in 2026. Specifically, what we're talking about here, we can perform a life-saving, almost a total reconstruction of the heart valve or many other problems in the heart without ever opening the chest. So the heart surgery we're talking about has no comparison, no relevance to the heart surgery of 10 or 20 years ago. It's completely different. It's the least invasive surgery we've ever seen in medicine.
And so before you did the surgery, what is the practice like? Because we've seen doctors practicing sutures or different ways of controlling the equipment in the operating room. How do you perform those practice runs before you get to where you were?
Well, listen, we're only good at things we do often. And we live, eat, breathe, and sleep this type of surgery. In particular, we're talking about a valve in the heart called the mitral valve. Why is that important? 3 to 5% of all of the audience out there has this condition. Mm. But a couple problems. Many don't know they have it, meaning they know a relative who may have died from it. They may have been told they have a heart murmur. They need to come for advanced diagnostics. Once they come for those diagnostics, we can then design a precision surgical operation to help them address that. And that then conveys lifelong benefits. So how do we practice? We do this every day. We do it night and day, around the clock. We've been doing this for 21 years. We've published, we've taught this. And really, this is like as simple as, for us, driving a car to the hospital. And that's why, as a patient, you want to go to someone with experience and decades of outcomes.
And, you know, this was a single-port robotic surgery. I mean, you could have continued doing the traditional robotic procedure that uses five ports. What motivated you to say, you know, can we make this even less invasive?
We're in this for our patients. When we go into medicine, when we build teams like we are at Corewell Health, our singular goal is putting the patient first and doing better for our patients, the families, and the community we serve each day. And that is completely aligned with our mission. Having a patient undergo life-saving surgery through two small cuts versus five is a game changer. There's less bleeding, there's less pain, there's less recovery. And in the patient we're talking about here today, he was able to return home on the third day and help his family lift and start generators with the Michigan-wide power outage that occurred over July 4th weekend. It's truly remarkable. And for all patients out there who are thinking, I can't have my heart fixed because I can't drop my responsibilities in life, we don't need to worry about that anymore. Mm. Having a single-port robotic procedure or even a multi-port, if necessary, will allow you to have life-saving, life-changing surgery and get back to the activities that you need to do and love.
Yeah, and this first patient, Patrick O'Brien of Royal Oak, 60 years old, not old,
No. But
as you do get older, these surgeries can become a little more strenuous on your body, and you might not react the way you would when you were a bit younger. He said he was up and back to work in a week. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing, this type of surgery, how less invasive it is than previous surgeries and surgical operations. But the fact that you can actually do this successfully, it has to feel like you are on a completely new trajectory now.
Absolutely. So the message for the audience and the public, because that's what we're here for, is to say, listen, if you know you have heart disease, come get an advanced diagnostic workup. Number two, don't be afraid. There are new options that we're creating literally daily that can save your heart and get you back to the life that you love. Number three, everybody's worried about longevity. This is the ultimate longevity fix. Fixing your heart will make you live longer and feel better. And look, gentlemen, that's what we all want, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely. And is this procedure available to everyone with a leaking mitral valve, or are there certain patients who are, you know, better candidates than others?
Well, in medicine, we say we never say always and we never say never, meaning it depends. Every patient is different. Again, going back to advanced diagnostics, we now have a painless, quick scan, whole body scan at Corewell Health that our imaging experts have developed called CT angiogram with 3D gated reconstruction. That's a lot of words. That's just to say that once you're aware of the fact that you may have a heart condition, please contact us. We'll get you through this scanner. We'll know in minutes what you have wrong and whether you're a candidate for single port robotics surgery, multi-port robotic surgery, or some other type of procedure like a transcatheter valve repair or a traditional sternotomy. Every patient is different. And what we do in cardiovascular medicine and surgery now is we tailor the therapy to the patient. So in other words, these are precision therapies that bestow long-term longevity benefits.
So this is a minimally invasive heart surgery. When you start getting into maybe more heavy heart surgeries, open heart surgery, things like that, how much closer does this type of breakthrough then take us to, well, we could be getting even closer to less invasive major heart surgeries?
Well, we're going to continue to innovate. This is our first procedure. We actually have been practicing five other heart procedures utilizing the single port robot. Just like we've done with this one, we spend hundreds of hours practicing as a team. It's not only the surgeon, it's the anesthesiologists and the nurses and the nurse practitioners and the pump techs and everybody, including hospital administrators who come together, allocate the resources, practice together night and day, and then when we're ready, we will launch the procedure. So we've launched single port robotic mitral valve repair. We have several other patients already waiting to have this procedure done, and we've got them scheduled just as quickly as we can to get them through, get their lives saved, and get them back to normal activities. Next on the horizon is aortic valve replacement, tricuspid valve repair, atrial septal defect closure, removal of the muscle, septal myectomy, and even coronary artery bypass surgery. So that's a lot. But just to say to the public, we're here for you. This is scary. We're here to make it simple, easy, and to provide you with literally the latest innovations as they are invented. And we're doing that relentlessly here at Corewell Health.
Well, we're so happy that your patient, Patrick O'Brien, is feeling well. We're so thrilled that this type of innovation is happening at Corewell Health. Thank you for your time, Dr. Rakeshuri. We appreciate it. Congratulations. And we'll talk again soon, we hope.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for the hard work you do in getting this message out. It's really appreciated.
Certainly.
Thank you, sir.
Very, very cool.
Oh, man.
Coming up on the other side, Steve Yzerman is out as general manager. Who steps in next? We talk to Helene St. James on JR Morning. So Steve Yzerman out as general manager, and now the search begins. According to a press release yesterday, Chris Illich is going to head up the search for a new general manager of the Detroit Red Wings. And Steve Yzerman is staying on as an advisor to Chris Illich. But now there's a turnover. And what that means, what led to this, let's talk about it. And where do we go next? With Helene St. James, the hockey writer for the Detroit Free Press. Helene, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
I was a little bit surprised by the timing of this. I thought if Steve Yzerman was no longer to be the GM of this team, this organization, it may have happened closer to the end of the season, but it happened yesterday. What did you think of the timeline here?
I completely agree with you. I mean, and to me, it indicates it was more Steve's decision to step aside than him being pushed out, because if they were unhappy with him, I thought the organization wanted a change. That should have happened in you know, late April, not the middle of July.
Well, wasn't he making draft picks and signing free agents just, you know, days ago?
No, he absolutely was. That's the other thing. I mean, they, you know, the timing of it again. I mean, it's we've had the draft, free agency, everything. This is usually when NHL teams, you know, kind of go quiet and everybody's at their cottage and you know. So yeah, it is, the timing of it is mm-hmm. is very odd.
I think the first question that came to my mind was, okay, well, Dylan Larkin, what was the role that did he play a role here? Does he reconsider staying with this organization?
Yeah, I mean, that would be something. And I think in some ways the best solution for both, because it's been 2 months now since Dylan requested a trade, at least, and nothing has happened, because, you know, the Wings are in the position where they have to get immediate value return players for him. They can't trade him for a pick. Plus, you know, he gave them almost no choices in where to go. So now it's a lot to walk back, you know,
yeah.
2 months of this mess. So, but I think, you know, this is when maybe people consider, should, is it worth meeting, talking things out, and seeing if there's a way back? Plus, the other guy that it affects seemingly is Patrick Kane. I mean, he hasn't – the Wings certainly – Steve certainly tried to bring him back. He hasn't signed anywhere else yet, and mm-hmm. supposedly – allegedly is between the Sabres and the Blackhawks, but I know he liked playing here. So maybe, you know, this – you know, maybe the, this that's another domino that could fall if it looks like Larkin is going to – continue to stay in Detroit. But it would be, I think you'd have to hope a lot of fans forget what happened by the time the season starts.
Helene, when you kind of look back over the past 7 years, where do you think the rebuild actually went off course?
I think with the free agent signings, I mean, his first round draft picks, especially considering, you know, they haven't had any draft lottery luck, which I think is worth, you know, folk,
sure.
Like that's a very important point. But his free agent signings have been, you know, very pedestrian and not really worked out to expectation. And then there's been no exciting trade except maybe for DeBrincat. You know, like imagine right. if he had brought in Quinn Hughes last year. Like, yes, okay, it's a gamble, but you know, it would electrify the team and tell them, look, this is, I have higher expectations now. So I think, you know, the fact maybe he wasn't bolder in trying to make a trade, that factored into it as well. Because it's just, it's a mediocre team, you know, and March after March, we see them fold.
Yeah.
And Dylan does bear some blame for that too, by the way, though.
Sure. Yeah. And now the question is, where do we go from here? It feels like they have two paths that they can go, a fork in the road. They can go in the family or they can go outside. You know, Chris Draper's been the director of amateur scouting since Steve Yzerman got back to Detroit. He was the assistant general manager as well. I think that was in 2013 he was named to that position. You know, he has been very hands-on with this organization for a very long time. Or do they go outside and try to find someone from another organization? What's your instinct telling you? What are you hearing at this point?
Well, the other internal option would be Sean Horkoff, who's also an assistant general manager and has had more to do with running Grand Rapids and therefore a little more in what a general manager kind of role is. But I almost think, you know, we know Chris Illich, we know how it all in the Tigers are on analytics. I kind of tend to lean towards they're going to look outside and bring in somebody not in the family and more analytically oriented. I mean, I almost think you can't go from Steve to just promoting another former player.
Yeah.
You know, that didn't go so well the first time.
I'm wondering how attractive this general manager position is around the NHL. I mean, is it still viewed as a premier job despite this long playoff drought we've had here?
Oh, I think so. I mean, it's you know, a very high profile job, and it's also an incredibly challenging job because, you know, we see. Unless you're one of the in teams like Florida or Vegas or Minnesota right now, it can be really hard to attract players. And, you know, now we're seeing all these players, you know, with no trade clauses, with protected movement clauses, dictate where they want to go. But they can't all go play in Florida, you know. So,
right.
So no, but I don't think it will be a problem convincing somebody to come take that job.
Mm. Interesting stuff. Thank you for staying on top of it for us, Helene St. James at the Free Press. We appreciate your time as always.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. You got it. Interesting stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
here in Hockey Town.
I'm telling you. I mean, like I said, he was just, you know.
Oh, yeah. He's been busy.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about
and then,
that.
Boom. You know.
Coming up on the other side, 7 o'clock hour. Get you caught up on the headlines. We'll hit the couch with Dr. Steve Craig in the next hour. Also, Rusty Hills is going to join us. Michigan, are these gubernatorial candidates on the Republican side running for your vote or Trump's? It's next on JR Morning. A hazy
you
Thursday.
You can't see down
a
the street.
Smoky Thursday. No, you can't.
You can't. You know, we're on the eighth
floor. We're eight
floor,
floors up.
And you can't see downtown.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Wow.
It's pretty crazy. This is the smoke from these wildfires that are rolling in. And, yeah, you can smell it. You can feel it out there.
Oh, yeah.
It is thick, 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 thick stuff. And, you know, the other part, too, is up north, they were hit before we were.
Yes.
There was ash falling from the sky.
Wow. You say it looked like snow. It
looked like snow. I mean, people, I was looking at pictures and videos from people of, you know, they go out to their dock. Docks covered in ash.
Sure.
They go out to their car. Cars covered in ash.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was everywhere up there. I mean, even pictures of the Mackinac Bridge, couldn't see the bridge.
Wow.
Couldn't see the bridge. So you've got this smoke alert in effect for today.
Yes.
And it's for good reason.
Absolutely.
For good reason. I mean, I woke up on my way in. I'm like, hey, somebody's having a bonfire at 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
I'm telling you, it was orange. I'm walking Sasha yesterday evening, and it was orange outside.
Yeah. Yeah, wild stuff.
So if you have asthma, have you know, any type of respiratory issues going on, you don't want to be outside today.
Not today.
No.
Meanwhile, we do have an update on the cyclosporiasis cases, and it's not as big of a jump as it has been the last few days.
No, we have 3,700 cases now have been reported across the U.S. and at least
3,400 cases.
I'm sorry,
3,700 cases in Michigan. Yeah.
And 44 people have been hospitalized. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services says its investigation points to, of course, lettuce and salad greens. We've been talking about that as a likely source, though a specific grower or supplier still has not been identified. Health officials recommending buying whole heads of lettuce instead of the bag salad mixes, and taking off the outer leaves, thoroughly washing the inner leaves. And symptoms include severe watery diarrhea, stomach cramps, nausea, low-grade fever, can begin up to 2 weeks after exposure. And even if you're if you have fruits like bananas and oranges, you know, things with peels, you know, you still want to wash them as well. A lot of people feel like, well, I'm just going to peel this away and I'm fine. No, you need to wash that as well, because as you cut into a fruit, you know, whatever is on the outside, you're going to kind of pull it into the inside of the fruit. So you want to make sure it's clean on the outside as well.
Interesting. Meanwhile, Steve Yzerman is out as GM of your Detroit Red Wings. You know, and now the search is on. The release from the organization yesterday was that Steve Yzerman has stepped down from his position. You made a great point. I mean, just the last week or so,
yes.
You go through the draft, you go through, you know,
signing
players.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And now it's, okay, well, what's next? You know, who is going to be the next general manager of this team? And, you know, Chris Ilitch is going to lead up that search. And, you know, some of the obvious answers internally are Chris Draper.
Of course.
Who's been with the organization forever and a day. Sean Horkoff as well, both assistant general managers here. And but then, of course, you could go outside and bring in a fresh perspective, a fresh ideology, mm-hmm. and maybe go hard reset to try to turn this thing around. But, yeah, I mean, over the last 7 years, they have not progressed the way fans, A, had expected or B, wanted.
And it seems like it gets to a certain point every year where they kind of go down.
Yeah, end of the year.
Yeah.
End of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Where they need to win a handful of games and they can't win.
They can't do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just to get into the playoffs. That's not even being like a contender.
Contender. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Michigan State University President Kevin Guskowitz says he is committed to staying at MSU after reversing his decision to leave for Clemson University. Guskowitz had announced his departure earlier this year, citing concerns over disagreements within the university's board of trustees. And after receiving widespread support from students, alumni, and figures like basketball coach Tom Izzo, Guskowitz reconsidered following discussions with board members and the Spartan community. He revised his revised contract extends through 2031 with a salary increase of $1.5 million. Guskowitz says his focus now is restoring stability, strengthening MSU, and moving the university forward.
Yeah, it's certainly good news for Michigan State.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I remember when we had Mark Hollis in studio, you know, obviously he's a former athletic director at Michigan State, and you know, the idea of having those discussions with the board is really important. Not to say that Kevin Guskowitz never did.
No, right.
But there were some more heart-to-hearts, it sounds like, that maybe took place, and, mm-hmm. and he decided to stay. It's great news for Michigan State.
It is. And, you know, we still need to find a president for U of M. That hasn't happened as of yet, and we need to get some stability there as well.
Well, they may need be in the market for an athletic director as well. Ward Manuel might be
exactly.
taking some sort of buyout package. There's a lot going on.
Detroit City Football Club moving closer to a permanent home in Southwest Detroit. Mayor Mary Sheffield team officials broke ground yesterday on Alumni Field, a privately funded 15,000-seat stadium being built at the former Southwest Detroit Hospital site near Michigan and 20th Street. The stadium will feature a natural grass field, European-style grandstands, space for soccer, concerts, community events. Originally planned to open in 2027, the stadium now expected to welcome fans for the 2028 USL Championship season. DCFC says more than 6,000 season ticket deposits have been placed already for the new home.
Yeah. People love this team.
Wow.
And the when you go down there, the vibe is off the charts.
Oh, it's crazy.
I mean, it is very, very cool.
Yeah.
So I'm glad they're getting a new home, a permanent home, their home.
Yes, their home.
Yeah, very cool. Coming up on the other side, Dr. Steve Craig in studio. We'll get on the couch with him. But first at 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community here on WJR. All right, Thursday at 7:19. As always, we welcome in Dr. Steve Craig, the president of Craig Consulting Group and Craig Counseling Services.
with another doozy for us. Good morning.
Hard to get here today. You can't even see outside.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, look at it out the window. It's nuts.
Yeah, I left a little fire in my fireplace last night. Did I put it out?
That's what it feels like.
Is there a neighborhood on fire?
Exactly. Right. That's what Brian said. Yeah. He thought his house was on fire.
I'm like, wow. All right, Dr. Steve, this weekend, my brothers and I need to take the car keys away from our 88-year-old father. He's belligerent and demanding to drive and says even if the state doesn't pass him, because we're making him take a test, he's driving anyway.
Okay.
He dismisses our mom and says he hasn't had any accidents and insists he's fine. We would like some advice on how to have this conversation. He is going to be angry and dismiss us, but we have to do this as he is clearly incapable of driving. There's no doubt that he would be dangerous on the road. So do we just lay out the law to him and reason with him? Do we get tough and just force him? Do we let him explain why he thinks he should and then counter? My oldest brother wants to remind him that he had to take the keys from his father-in-law after he had a few accidents 30 years ago, and he thinks maybe this will persuade him. Any suggestions would be helpful. He doesn't ask for both you guys specifically, but I'm sure he meant that you guys would have great answers
sure,
to this.
Right,
sure. Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, I just think, you know, the family, first of all, has to be all on one page when they address him and tell him about this. And this is not about, and I know he probably feels like this is taking away his independence. But this is not about that. I think you let him say his piece. You listen. You let him say his piece. But you tell him, like, this is not taking away your independence. We're doing this out of love. We love you. We don't want anything to happen to you. We don't want anybody to run into you. We don't want you to run into anybody. And it's just safer this way. And I think bottom line is going to be safety. Yeah, he's going to be ticked off today and maybe tomorrow. But I'd rather for you to be ticked off in here than not ticked off and gone.
Hmm. So Lloyd loses the conversation. Your turn.
So I imagine at 88, because there's different 88s, right? You could have somebody who is spry, incredibly aware and alert. But if they're taking the keys away from him, my assumption is that he's not that. He might be an elderly man who just is trying to get around.
Yeah.
Can you just take the keys. He's 88. What, is he going to wrestle you to the ground? I don't think so. Just take the keys away.
That's what happened to my dad.
Go in at 9:30 at night when he's asleep and take the keys. It's very simple.
No.
But really, though.
Oh, problem solved. No argument. He'll just go, oh, never mind then.
I guess I'm not going anywhere.
Have you seen my keys? No other conflict will occur.
You could do what you do with my kids and just like if there's a toy that's really obnoxious, you just hide it and go, what toy?
Pretend it didn't happen.
I don't think we ever had. I don't remember that.
What car keys?
Hey,
Buick.
Did you misplace them, Dad? You misplace them because you said you didn't.
Can I pretend to be the 88-year-old?
Okay, we can role play this if you want. Yeah, you can both be.
Let's make the case. That.
Okay. What keys?
How dare you come into my home? I am an adult. You are not my boss. This is my car. I paid for this car.
Ooh.
This is my life. You don't get to dictate my life.
I've had no accidents.
Yeah.
I'm okay. I've been driving for 60 years.
Yeah.
So you cannot take my independence away from me.
Well, you can't find the keys.
What keys? No.
Let me counter, but let me tell you what I'm going to be doing with it first.
Okay.
The problem with these conversations is we can't let the person take us on a journey. So you have it with your teenage kids or your spouses or whatever. Uh-huh. Whenever you want to make a point and you need to be firm on it, when they counter, if we allow the counter to continue to go down that path, we go from A and then they say B and then we're in C and D and we're down the road.
Okay.
So the way to go about these things is to think of it like a boxing ring, that you're in a boxing ring and you go in the middle to have the conversation and then always return to your corner. Okay.
Okay.
So you go in and you know your main thing. So what I would say when you say it's my damn house and you came in and whatever, I would say, I understand how you feel about this. It is your house, but everyone here is in complete agreement about the fact that we do not think you're capable of driving, and if you do not pass the test, we are not in support of it. And then you say, well, go ahead, Lloyd, what did you say? I haven't had any accidents.
I haven't had any accidents. I've been driving for 60 years.
Right. I think it's great you haven't had any accidents, and we're trying to prevent that because an accident would be pretty serious. But everyone in this room is in complete agreement that you are no longer can be driving until you pass the test.
But I'm fine.
Right.
I haven't had any accidents.
I do understand you haven't had any accidents, and I realize that that's tough. But everyone in this room is in complete agreement that we are not going to support you driving until you pass the test.
All I do is...
I don't drive that far. I don't go far.
Right. I understand. I understand, which is great.
Take the keys.
Because we can...
Just get out of my house.
Right. Because I understand. But everyone in this room is not supportive of it, even if it's a few miles, and we're sorry to have this conversation, but we cannot let you drive. We are not in support of that.
I'm exhausted.
I am too. Take the keys.
But you see what I mean is that the person wants to engage you in an accident.
You're never getting down the road.
I'm never getting down the road. And I will go back to that corner again and again and again. And the person has no wiggle room. So whenever you're having difficult conversations like this, figure out what your corners are and just go.
Stay with
it. Step in, and then you have to end your sentence back in the corner, because if you leave it out there, it'll go further away.
Sure.
So keep coming back to that thing over and over again.
It's a tough scenario.
It's really tough.
It's tough.
Right, right. And again, do as I say, not as I do. With my mom, she wanted to keep driving, so we kept sabotaging her car.
We like, cut the brakes, siphon the gas out.
Like in the Sound of Music when the nuns, broke the car or whatever. Yeah, we just kept disconnecting the battery, and she would go on and go, my car's broken again. And go, well, we'll take it to the mechanic. We'd hide it in our driveway for a couple weeks.
Uh-huh.
Then we'd bring it back, and it's fixed. And then she'd go, I tried, it didn't work. Oh, that darn car, what are we going to do? So I'm not saying that we did
that's
it well
diabolical.
Ourselves.
Yeah. That's diabolical.
That's worse than pretending there's no keys anymore.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But that was a different scenario. And in this particular one, it's a good example of how to have that conversation and keep control of it when you keep going back to your corner. So.
Wow.
It's like, Brian, we don't like this topic on the show.
Yeah.
We're all in agreement. Brian, we don't like this topic on the show.
I know you don't like it, but we're going to discuss this.
I understand you feel that way, but we don't like this topic on the show.
No, we don't care how many accidents you've had, Brian.
You want my keys? Then
come
get them.
That's right.
So now you take the keys from your parent, and now are you chauffeur?
I guess.
If you're going to do this compassionately for a while, you should be chauffeur.
Sure.
You should, because you truly are taking from them independence, which is a tremendous thing. So whatever you can do.
Yeah.
And get them Ubers here and there. And I think in time what happens is they start to accept the Uber drive as their new independence.
Uh-huh.
But make a transition to that.
Yes.
But you can't day one go, well, get an Uber. You have to say,
right.
You know.
Figure it out.
Figure it out.
Put your thumb up.
Remember what you told me when I was in high school? Figure it out. I've been waiting for 50 years to say this to you. Figure it out.
Dr. Steve, appreciate you as always. Thank you.
See you guys.
Take a break. More next. Well, obviously, there is a strong push towards artificial intelligence here in the United States, but other countries are taking ambitious bets as well, like the United Arab Emirates. They are integrating AI directly into everyday government services. In Abu Dhabi, residents are using a TAM app, which is a considerate done, which acts as a digital government assistant. It can remind users when key documents like national IDs or health insurance or vehicle registration needs to be renewed. It's got an auto-gov feature that can automatically complete paperwork and even make required payments on the user's behalf. And the whole idea here is to make interacting with the government seamless, all with artificial intelligence.
Wow.
That, to me, is not something that feels even remotely possible here in the United States.
So what, you imagine waking up, your driver's license has been renewed, that parking ticket you got was paid.
Right.
Health insurance updated. You didn't even lift a finger.
Well, and the United Arab Emirates has invested billions and billions of dollars into AI infrastructure and research as part of their long-term strategy. So it isn't just the United States, but could we see more of this technology being integrated into our daily lives like this. Karthik Nandakumar is the Associate Professor of Computer Science and Engineering at Michigan State University and joins us to talk about it. Professor, it's good to have you.
Hi, good to see you.
How did the UAE get to this point? They've obviously been investing in the research and development side of it, but now they are jumping in head first.
Yeah, so basically they realized almost a decade back that oil is no longer going to work for them in the long term. So they decided to work on digital data, digital transformation, data, and AI. So they were one of the first to introduce this Ministry of AI, and they tried to introduce AI into every possible government interaction that is for working in the UAE. So that is how they decided to get into this project. That's how this started a decade back, basically.
You know, I'm sure for a lot of our listeners, you know, what they're doing with the UAE is doing, I mean, it sounds incredibly convenient, but at what point does that convenience start kind of raising concerns about privacy?
Yeah, so right now what they are trying to use is they are not trying to build these kind of big large language models and this AI agents, which is what the big tech US companies are trying to do. So that is where you need lots of data, lots of private information and so on.
Yeah.
So what these people are trying to do is just trying to take these models and then try to make them user-friendly, how to help people in their daily interactions and so on. So there, it's more or less like digital payments or digital activities, right? So it's not that privacy sensitive, since they are not building any of these large language models, just like the U.S. big tech companies do.
Very interesting. Karthik Nandakumar, thank you so much for your time and insight on this. It's unbelievable what the UAE is doing. Fascinating story. We'll talk again soon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you got it.
This I mean, it doesn't surprise me, man, with this. This is just going bonkers, man, everywhere.
It feels like that is big government to the nth degree.
Oh, yeah.
And I just don't see something like that happening here in the United States, at least anytime soon.
No.
Former President Joe Biden is releasing a book on his presidency and both his decisions to run for reelection and eventually step aside. It's going to be published shortly after the midterm elections. It will be released November 17th. The book is called Promise Me America. And I cannot help but to think that this is an attempt to rewrite the narrative around Joe Biden.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. Because there are questions, and people have their own narratives, and he wants to try to change those narratives.
Yeah, and I mean, look, it's not surprising that a former president releases a book.
No, no. Okay,
not surprising.
No, you do it all the time.
But the First Lady released a book recently. Mm-hmm. Hunter Biden has been out much more. I mean, he's on podcast galore. He's talking about bleep Trump, blah, 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 blah.
And then he got, right? He won some money too, didn't he? I think he won a lawsuit recently as well.
Well, the reality is after that book that detailed the inside inner workings of the Biden administration, particularly the inner circle of advisors close to the president, close to the First Lady, close to the family, and the efforts that they went to, the lengths that they went to keep them away or him away from other influential Democrat lawmakers on Capitol Hill who were out, you know, going, this guy's fine. He's not walking around like a Roomba.
Yeah.
He's fine. He's not talking to people who at the G7 in Italy when nobody's there. He's fine.
Yeah.
Oh, the debate. It's just a momentary relapse.
Mm-hmm.
All these people were going out in support of him when they didn't realize he was struggling.
He was, yeah.
And his mental capacity was degrading.
Yeah.
And it feels like now there is an attempt to rewrite all of this. And he's talking about, well, we're going to talk about, you know, the 2020 election, why I decided to run, why I decided to drop out, why we ultimately went with Kamala Harris, all of these things. But he's not going to talk about, like, the border, for example, which was an unmitigated disaster during his presidency.
Right.
He's going to try to rewrite some of this stuff. And again, it's your former president, write a book, it's fine. People are going to read it. But it feels hollow.
I wonder if he's going to talk about the debate. and how, you know, how he fared on the debate, because his wife, you know, she had her own thoughts about, you know, first he had a cold, he was taking medication, it was a lot of different things. So is that going to be discussed? You know, Kamala Harris in her book said some things. Let's see if he's going to contradict some of the things that she said in her book.
Right. I mean, Joe Biden after that debate was like, good job, Joe. You answered all the questions good. Like,
yeah.
I was like, what are we doing here?
Come on.
You know, so again, it's like we saw what happened. We know what happened.
Sure.
And again, I have no problem with him writing a book. He mentions that his prostate cancer treatment's been going well. I'm
Which
so happy
great.
To hear that.
That's excellent.
But it just feels like it's not, this isn't what I think he expects it to be. Because, again, we saw what was going on.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think it's odd. And again, for former First Lady releases her book. He's mm-hmm. releasing his book.
Mm-hmm.
It's what it feels like to me, yeah. trying to rewrite things. Coming up on the other side, Rusty Hills joins us. He's the former chair of the Michigan Republican Party. Wrote an interesting piece about Michigan gubernatorial candidates, particularly Republicans, that are running to be the head of Donald Trump's fan club and not Michigan governor. Interesting take. We'll talk to him next on JR Morning. So Rusty Hills in the Detroit Free Press wrote a piece, Republicans are blowing their best chance to win Michigan. And the main contention here is that they are currying more favor towards the White House and the president of the United States than what is best for the state of Michigan. It's an interesting perspective from a Republican in Rusty Hills, who's now teaching professor in public policy at the University of Michigan, also past chair of the Michigan Republican Party, and joins us this morning. Rusty, it's great to have you back.
Oh, great to be on with your show with you and Lloyd this morning. Thank you.
What are you seeing out of these candidates that make you believe that they're pandering more to the president than to the voters here?
I mean, it's everybody wants to be, you know, I use the same deodorant he does. I use the same, you know, mouthwash he does. I mean, it's just like, you know, and here's the thing. Look, we've got a lot of issues. You guys talk about this stuff all the time. You were just talking about artificial intelligence. You're talking about all these things. How do we make Michigan better? And look, you guys know it probably better than I do, because you talk to so many interesting people every morning. But, you know, I see it firsthand at U of M. We've got great students and just the best and the brightest. But so many of them get that graduate degree or undergrad degree from U of M, and then they leave. And they go to all these other places like Boston and Chicago and even Midwestern spots like Columbus and Indianapolis. I mean, they take all that brightness with them. And then, you know, they start families and pay taxes elsewhere. We have got to do a better job of keeping kids here, keeping our best and brightest here. And not just the kids. I mean, everybody needs better jobs, better opportunities, more housing. Look, Gretchen Whitmer has left us a target-rich environment. There's so many issues that need to be tended to. And I think that the governorship is there for the taking. If a Republican candidate can kind of articulate, look, I've got a plan that's going to make this state better for you, for your friends, for your neighbors, for your community. That's what I'm trying to convey.
And Rusty, you mentioned education and affordable housing and better paying jobs. Which of those issues do you think, you know, voters are more likely to decide this election on?
You know, great question, Lloyd. Look, I've been around a long time. For my money, Michigan is always about jobs, right? It is always about, can I get a good job with a decent pay that'll, you know, put a roof over my head, you know, take care of my spouse, take care of my kids. The job market is just a mess right now. I mean, you know, if you're trying to get a job, it is so difficult to break through these algorithms and even get a callback or an interview anymore. It's so different, you know, than when all of us grew up. I mean, I'm probably older than all you guys, but, you know, just so much different. And so we've got to get more vibrant, more hiring going. I think if you had a plan that would put people to work, that would be a powerful, powerful message for somebody to be the next governor of Michigan, in my opinion.
I mean, I'm with you. I think I would, you know, I've been contending really ever since those back-to-back debates that we need more steak, less sizzle. Like, I understand they're trying to paint the contrast, but isn't that kind of the nature of this point on the calendar in the primaries when you're just trying to court voters in your own party to identify what kind of separation there are from other primary candidates?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you know, you got to grant you that. I mean, Trump has a very powerful track record of getting his endorsees winners in the primary. So there's no question about that. Although that's already happened now. We're past that stage, right? He's weighed in. We know he's supporting John James. Given that, let's move past that now. Let's tell me what your plan is. Don't, you know, what are you going to do to bring jobs? What are we going to do to fix third grade reading? That's a huge issue. We've got to do a better job of education. I mean, my gosh, we're below Mississippi when it comes to third grade reading. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? Right?
Right.
And the governor said, now we're going to focus on that now in her eighth year. I mean, come on. So there's a lot of things we need to do. Look, here's one of my pet peeves. I'll pass this along. I know we're under time constraint this morning, but you know, you over on I-95 years ago, I don't know if you remember this, there was a huge accident. And it was so powerful, the explosion and the fire, that it literally burned through I-95. And so the whole interstate on the East Coast got shut down. And they had to run traffic through some poor neighborhood in Philadelphia. Well, you know, the governor, Josh Shapiro, to his credit, sat down with the Department of Transportation, Buttigieg, and said, look, we got to get this thing fixed. So they basically, you know, put on hold all these regulations that they had, all this crazy stuff, and said, look, we're going to work three shifts a day around the clock to rebuild I-95. And by gosh, within about 6 weeks, they got that thing back up and running. Why don't we do that with all the construction we've got in Michigan? I mean, you guys drive like I do. Well, like, you're on I-94, I'm in construction. You're on I-75, I'm in construction. I go to Lansing, I'm in construction. How much money would we save? How much productivity would our state save if we were able to say to these crews, look, you guys work round the clock, and we'll give you a bonus if you get done sooner.
Right.
We'll give you and your team bonuses. But get this stuff done. Oh, my God. You'd get reelected. You know, they would carry you on your shoulder right. to Lansing if you did that.
You know, Rusty, you've watched Michigan politics evolve over many years. What kind of leadership do you think Michigan needs now to compete economically over the next generation, rather than just, you know, trying to recreate the wheel in the past?
Yeah, you know what? We don't need a showboat. We need a workhorse, somebody that's going to just put their, you know, shoulder to the grind and just get stuff done. I'm lucky enough to be friends with Mike DeWine, the governor down in Ohio. And I think he and Ohio are eating our lunch when it comes to jobs. We really need to retool our whole approach. Michigan's got so much to offer. We've got such a great state with two peninsulas and four great lakes. And we've got hardworking people from one end of the state to the other. There's no reason why we shouldn't be outcompeting Indianapolis and Ohio and Wisconsin for jobs. And I think if we get the right person in there, we can fix our education system. If we can bring jobs back to the state, boy, everybody here, all the folks I know are hardworking. You bring a company here, you're going to have people to put in a great day's work for you. We've got to do a better job of, you know, offering Michigan and bringing jobs here. I think the opportunity is there. Republicans, the office of governor is there for the taking. If we can offer up some sort of a policy that appeals to people for what they want.
Do you think there is that workhorse candidate there?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think the opportunity's there. You know, I sure hope so.
Yeah.
We need it.
Really interesting stuff. Interesting take. Rusty Hills, we appreciate you as always. Thanks for popping on with us this morning.
Hey, great to talk to you guys. Yeah, hang in there. Take care of that smoke, okay?
Oh, I know. Man, we're trying.
I know. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy right. out there this morning. Thanks, Rusty. You know, and I think it was in the Detroit News this morning, Nolan Finley had a take, a 1 6-year term for governor.
Oh, instead of the 2-4.
1 6-year term and you're out. What do you make of that?
Oh, I mean, you know, I'm okay with that. I think I'd be okay with that.
You know, one of the interesting things that popped up in my mind when I read this piece was, okay, that's fine. I understand the rationale for it. But one of the things, like, even on the geopolitical stage, they know that there's only a 4-year time frame for president. So if things don't go well, you'll get the next 4 years, maybe with somebody else.
Yeah.
Right. And so there is that constant turnover that nothing is really going to be permanent. Things can change down the road. it almost feels like if you're not giving somebody enough time to do the job, what kind of job are they going to do?
Yeah, but if they weren't doing the job in six, they're not going to do it in eight.
Fair enough. And that's certainly the counter to that argument. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Coming up on the other side, 8 o'clock hour, get you caught up on the headlines, also talking more AI, and Jamie joins us in the 8 o'clock hour. All that and more coming up on JR Morning. All right, 8 o'clock hour, smoke lingering all across the area.
My goodness.
I mean, I think it's getting heavier.
It looks like it.
Here.
You can't see downtown.
No, it is crazy. It is absolutely crazy. And some of the videos yesterday and pictures that I was seeing from up north, just the ash that was falling looked like it was snowing up north. The ash on the docks, the boats, the cars, all over the place. An unbelievable scene. And then, of course, if you're already on your way to work, you've smelled it.
Oh, no, you can't help but smell it.
I mean, it's very pungent.
You can be
like
in your house
a bonfire
and smell it and probably think your house is on fire like Brian did this morning. He woke up this morning. He said, what's burning in my house?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've got Henry's doing a little summer camp this week.
Uh-huh.
And today they were going to play outside. It's going to be a water day. They're supposed to come in their bait. And I'm thinking, like, there's no way these kids are going outside today.
No, my granddaughter cheerleads. And, they cheerlead outside. They have practice outside. Not today.
Got to move those mats inside.
Got to move them inside. Nope.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And this is something now we've come to expect the last couple of years. Really, the last handful of years we've had this, where around this time, these wildfires in Canada blow over towards our direction. And
I just don't remember it being
Do not remember it being this thick.
Yes.
No, that I do not remember it being this thick. But there is that that advisory in place because of this. It's not going to be quite as hot today. Still going to be very hot. I don't think we're going to get into the real feels like it's 100 again.
No.
But now we've got something else to worry about outside.
So. Well, you got to, Wayne County officials say the air quality levels are moderate, but the range could worsen, I think they have worsened already. And residents are urged to check conditions before they spend extended time outdoors. People with respiratory conditions and children, older adults should take extra precaution, because this stuff, I mean, I was out walking Sasha yesterday. It looked orange outside. I started coughing once I got back to the house, and then I had a headache, and I'm like, where did this headache come from? I know it came from this freaking smoke.
Yeah, hazardous and unhealthy, according to airnow.gov. Michigan's air quality index right now, the AQI, it's red. Heavy red in our area. And and even like I was watching video of a plane.
Okay.
And they're just flying and it just looks completely orange.
Wow.
Out there. Yeah. So it's interesting. I don't remember this, but if you do have some, as you mentioned, respiratory issue.
Yes.
It's a good day to stay inside.
The nationwide outbreak of cyclosporiasis. That continues to grow. Michigan remaining one of the hardest hit states, more than 3,700 cases here. About 44 people have been hospitalized. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services says its investigation points to lettuce or salad greens as the likely source, but they still haven't, got a specific grower or supplier identified as of yet. And health officials recommend buying whole heads of lettuce instead of the bag salad mixes. And, if you're going to the supermarket, Chris, I haven't really seen a lot of the bag salad mixes. They've taken them out. But if you buy a whole head of lettuce, you take off the outer leaves and then thoroughly wash the inner leaves and make sure you get it nice and clean. And also, if you are cleaning fruit, with peels, like a orange or a banana or something like that. A lot of people say, well, I'm not eating a peel, so I don't need to wash it. No, you need to wash that as well thoroughly.
Yeah. So I've got this, and it's a wild ride, I'll tell you.
Oh, yeah.
It's like some days you feel decent, other days you feel really bad, and you're using the facilities a lot. And other days I feel nauseous.
Yeah. My son went through it, too, so he just got through it, and he's done and he feels back to normal again.
Yeah.
But he had it for at least a week. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on a week now.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to be on the backside of this
thing. Pretty soon. Yeah,
but meanwhile, Steve Yzerman out as the general manager of the Detroit Red Wings. Boy, the timing here is very odd to me.
That was it. I mean, I think people kind of had an inkling, but I think the inkling they had was closer to when the season ended as opposed to now.
Yeah, yeah. I thought if he was no longer going to be the general manager of this team, it was going to be after the season ended.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that he wasn't gone, the fact that he went through the draft, the fact that he signed a free agent, I was very surprised by the timing of this. But the organization said that he stepped down, and now the question is, okay, what happens with Dylan Larkin?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a relationship that can be mended there?
Yeah.
To keep him as part of this organization
and if
the
he's still
captain of this team.
And if he still wants to go after this, it makes you think that it was a deeper issue.
Sure. And maybe just wants to win, right? Like, that's fine too.
Nothing wrong with that.
And that wouldn't change his direction necessarily. Maybe he wants to just get out and try to win now. But who else do they replace Steve Yzerman with now? And there's a couple obvious options internally. Chris Draper, Sean Horkoff, both assistant general managers. Draper's the director of amateur scouting. Sean Horkoff has been working a lot with Grand Rapids, and the Griffins have had success there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, those are the options internally that I think are probably the most appealing, but they could go outside the organization too, and Chris Ilitch is going to lead that search.
And, you know, sometimes I want to know if that job is appealing to other potential candidates. But, you know, people like challenges. And because we've lost in these last several years, you know, not been in the playoffs. And so is it really a job that people are seeking? But, you know, you have those out there who love challenges, and they would love to come here and turn this franchise around. It would be a big deal.
Well, the realities are that there's only 32 NHL teams.
Yeah.
There are only 32 jobs like this in the world. And this is an original six team. This is a town that absolutely loves hockey.
Crazy hockey
so
town.
It is an absolute destination. Now, you have to convince players, right? Because they're about contracts and money and being able to find a place to win.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think this is an incredibly enticing destination. They just got to find somebody that can do it.
A new WDIV Detroit News poll shows Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson holding a commanding lead in the Democratic race for governor among likely Democratic primary voters. Benson is backed by nearly 72%. Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson receiving just under 12%. About 16% remain undecided. Now, the poll found Benson enjoys significantly higher name recognition, nearly 89% of voters familiar with her, compared to 49% for Swanson. The survey of 500 likely Democratic primary voters was conducted July 8th through the 11th and has a margin of error of plus or minus 4.4 percentage points.
So she continues to lead big.
And then, you know, we spoke with Rusty Hills on the flip side, saying the Republicans, you know, they basically have an open shot at the governorship if they talk about the things that people want to hear and not just want to impress the president.
Well, it's easier to do that on the Democratic side because Jocelyn Benson has such an enormous lead.
Sure.
It's a lot harder to do when you still have three Republicans in this race and you're still doing debates and you're still trying to find that contrast between each candidate. So that is that's a bit of a different scenario, not quite apples to apples on these races.
Yes.
Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, the psychology of AI adoption at work. We're going to talk about that, what it means for work here in the state of Michigan. It's next here on JR Morning. So a new book set out for September 1st, The Psychology of AI Adoption at Work, From Resistance to Results. And obviously, we've talked a lot about artificial intelligence, the impact that it's going to have on the bottom line for companies, mm-hmm. but then what it means for jobs. Are these going to be tools for employees to use, or is it going to be a replacement for those employees? And it's something that Dr. Gleb Sapersky, the CEO of Disaster Avoidance Experts, has been looking at for quite some time, and his book is coming out in just a few weeks. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you back.
It's great to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk a little bit about the impetus for writing this book. Why go down this path? Why examine how artificial intelligence is going to be used in our workplace?
Well, obviously, people are really anxious about jobs, and employers are thinking about what to do about this as well. So my book really helps square the circle and create a win-win situation, because the way that many employers are thinking about it is getting various tools, apps that replace employees. My approach is different. It's telling employers that no, what you need to do is train your employees on how to use AI tools, not replace them with AI tools. So the future of the workplace is employees who are managing a suite of AI agents, tools that they build themselves. And that helps employees protect their own jobs, because the more you know how to use AI and be effective with it, the better your prospects in our increasingly AI-dominated future.
I know you found that employees often resist AI even when it could make their jobs easier. What's really driving that resistance? Is it fear of losing a job or fear of becoming irrelevant?
It's fear of losing their jobs because they're becoming irrelevant.
Okay.
So it's a combination of those. So what happens often is that employers tell employees, hey, here is an AI tool, now go ahead and use it. And employees are worried about it, and they're scared to use it, they're anxious to use it, and so they don't end up using it. And there was a study from MIT showing that 95% of AI initiatives don't show a return on investment in terms of profit for the company. And that's because the company doesn't empower employees to use AI tools effectively. It doesn't teach them how to use AI tools. It just buys AI tools and then says, go ahead and use them.
Right.
And because people are so anxious about them, they end up not using them. They're not trained on using them. They're not shown how these tools can be helpful for them. And then it's not really explained to them that, hey, if you use these tools effectively, you become the person who manages AI tools and who can actually do so much more than you previously could.
Yeah, to me, that's the real catalyst here is, as we sit here today before a lot of these companies go public, they're still in the investment phase. Well, when it's not in the investment phase and it becomes public and companies have to pay for this technology and they have to pay for the tokens, what is the ROI on those investments? Because it is going to be substantial. But if they're going to be able to do more work at a faster pace with less employees, then that's where you're going to see, I think, the most reap the biggest reward for these companies. But at the same time, we're in a weird middle ground, it seems like.
We are. And the thing is that what I tend to do when I work with companies is to make them help them make commitment to not let go of any employees because they're adopting AI, as long as the employees learn how to use AI tools effectively. So it's kind of a deal between the employer and the employee that, hey, you learn how to use AI tools effectively and we will not let anyone go. The companies definitely tend to put a freeze in hiring or hire many fewer people, but their existing people, as long as they're learning how to use AI tools, are definitely secure in their positions. And you have a lot of research showing that AI companies that adopt AI effectively actually tend to grow their headcount. So even though they say, well, we'll freeze hiring, what happens is that these companies tend to have their internal employees learn how to use AI effectively. And then because the companies are using AI effectively, they're growing. They have more demand. They have more clients. They are accomplishing more work. They're winning market share against companies that don't. So they naturally need to hire more people in order to satisfy their new clients, their new client base. And so it's a nice win-win for the companies that partner with their employees to use AI effectively, rather than the companies that are trying to think about, well, now I'm going to use AI, I'm going to replace my employees and cut them, and the AI and the employees are not using AI effectively. And those companies tend to lose market share because they're outcompeted by the companies where the managers and the employees are aligned on how they use AI effectively.
Doc, I'm sure parents are wondering how to prepare their kids for careers that may not even exist yet. How should they be thinking about education differently now?
Yeah, that's a really sad and challenging topic. So I do tend to see that companies I work with, even the best companies, they're definitely slowing down their hiring, and the people who they're hiring less is junior people. So this is quite challenging. And so what I tend to tell parents is there are a couple of ways that you can think about this. One is that there are a number of careers where AI is going to take a much longer time to replace people, namely careers that require physical interactions. So careers in the trades, it'll take a long, long time for a robot to do your plumbing or to do your electricity. So careers in the trades, that's one area where you can think about. Another area is an area with regulation. So for example, around medical, so medical careers, nursing and so on, there's a lot of regulation in those areas. It will take a long time for AI to replace people.
So
the
what
third
is it?
Area, if you
oh,
want,
sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
No worries. The third area, if you want to go into an area where AI is definitely able to do a lot of things, then the kid needs to really learn how to be an AI master, how to use AI super effectively, supremely effectively, and have that be very prominent on their resume and their portfolio, showing all the AI tools that they've built and so on. There's a lot of jobs that are still open, and the companies that I work with are hiring people for specifically who have AI skills. And so that's the third area that they need to be thinking about.
So we have,
if you're just, you know, going out with a degree in marketing, not AI skills, sorry.
Yeah, no. We have just the 30 seconds left here. So what does that mean for workers now in Michigan?
I think workers in Michigan need to really be thinking about their careers. So my book on the psychology of AI adoption from resistance to results coming out in September, what I talk about is how workers really need to orient toward becoming managers of AI, learning how to use AI effectively, and they need to partner with the employer to have win-win outcomes for everyone because of that.
Yeah, diversifying the skill set, right?
Sure.
Interesting stuff. Dr. Gleb Sapirsky, the CEO of Disaster Avoidance Experts, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much, and congratulations on the book. We can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Fascinating stuff. Really fascinating stuff.
Absolutely.
Because there is, and I think rightfully so, there is concern about what jobs will look like in the next 5-10 years down the road.
And you got people in their 50s and 60s who are thinking, I don't have time to learn all this. What do,
absolutely.
I, what do I do?
Sure.
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Coming up on the other side, big news for the Detroit Red Wings. What it means now that Steve Yzerman has stepped down as general manager. We'll talk about it next on JR Morning.
You know, Michigan summers mean outdoor adventure and fun, but high temperatures should not break your budget. Count on Consumers Energy to help make the most of this season and your budget with tips and ways to save. Making small changes like shifting some energy use to the morning or evening, raising your thermostat a couple of degrees, doing your laundry at night or on the weekends can help lower your bill while keeping your home comfortable. Discover more ways to beat the heat at consumersenergy.com/summer.
Meanwhile, we got the wildfires that are raging in Ontario, and we're seeing the fallout of that right here. I mean, it is.
I've never seen it this thick before.
It really feels like it's getting thicker.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just the sun is shining a little more now, but very orange hue outside. Bless you.
Thank you. Might be the smoke.
It's got to be the smoke outside. Be the smoke outside. Coming up on the other side, Jamie joins the show. Very special week for her. Last treatment, ringing the bell.
I was playing that song in my car after I saw that video.
What song?
You can ring my bell. Ring my bell. I had to play that.
That's very cool. We'll talk to Jamie coming up. It's JR Morning.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Woo! Woo! Boy, it's a great sound, isn't it?
I love it. Love it.
Jamie Edmonds completed her last chemo treatment this week and got to ring that bell. Jamie, what a video, what a sound it was. I love Olivia was there with you and rang it too.
Ryan, everybody.
Unbelievable stuff. Yeah. We're so happy.
I mean, I got emotional hearing it. I'm not even watching the video. It was it felt like such a milestone to hit after like 5 months of some really tough stuff. And I feel so great about it. And that second ring you hear is my child ringing.
Yes. And you know what, Jamie? I just when you rang the bell and seeing your face and you were crying, it was a cry of joy, but it also seemed like a kind of a cry of relief as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I just said, 5 months of like despair and dark times, and this is really hard to do to your body, and just like all of it was like flooding out after I rang it.
And you know, the chemo treatment you've been on for the last few weeks has been a little more intense than that initial round. Do you get a little boost knowing that you're done now? And I mean, obviously you're I'm sure you're still feeling the effects of it, but do you get a little boost knowing that that was the last one and you're through that part of the journey here?
Yeah, these side effects are a little easier to handle knowing it's the last time. Hopefully, knock on wood, right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
But yeah, it's a lot easier to handle this time.
So what's next, Jamie, after this? You get a little downtime right now, correct?
Yeah, so now they do scans, and there's anxiety over all that. Like, what's it looking like in there right now? But there's scans, and then they let your body heal a little bit, and then I have surgery in the middle of August. So there's still a road here, but that was just – it's been such a big week.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, the podcast continues, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way, and we've got a new episode of that dropping this week – or dropping today.
Yeah, today. So I thought it would be good to have an infusion nurse – for this week, because, you know, this was the last chemo, and just these are angels inside of Henry Ford who do all this work, who administer the drugs to all of our fellow cancer patients who are there. And so I have a chemo infusion RN on this week's pod, and we talk about the process. We try and make it less scary if, say, someone's listening and they haven't done it yet, and just like some of the anecdotes that she has along the way.
You know, still helping people, Jamie. You're still helping people, even though your journey continues. You're still helping people, and that's so great.
Well, that's the hope. I hope people are listening and they're getting helped by it or in some way, and it's resonating. That's been my goal this whole time.
Well, and these are your angels, but there are a lot of people's angels, because it's, you know, like we get, I'm sure you guys get it a lot in this business too. It's like, well, how do you do that? How do you tell a story, a really sad story, or how do you talk about politics every day? And it's like, well, eventually it's your job, and it's something that you enjoy doing, and you do it. And these people are literally helping save people's lives on a daily basis.
Sure.
And to me, that would have to, like, I just could never imagine being in that position. So I'm glad you're talking about that aspect, because I mean, they are literally giving people hope, giving people medicine, and helping people get better.
Well, yeah. And like, you develop relationships with these nurses, because I've been doing this for 5 months. I've been watching that Henry Ford Tower be built for 5 months,
right.
Talking to these people and asking them about their lives for a while. So you get to know them. And so I asked her that question. Her name is Erica Peck, and it'll be the podcast today. But I said, like, why did you choose this path? You could do any kind of nursing. It seems like there might be some sad stories attached to this kind of work. And she's like, well, I mean, there are, regardless of whatever, you know, subtype you pick of nursing, but there's also a lot of triumphs, like someone who gets through chemo and rings the bell. She likes watching that too.
You know, also there was a video. It was the video of you ringing the bell and Olivia
ringing
the bell.
It's true. We need context to this other video.
But the other video, you know, it seems like you were out kind of dancing a little bit. And they were like, oh, my God, Jamie has to do the dance when she comes back to the show. I said, listen, Jamie can get down, just so you know.
That was the front desk there at the Henry Ford Cancer Pavilion. And there is a man there who says hello and goodbye every time you walk in. I just love him.
Okay.
And when I was walking out, I was like, hey, guess what? It's my last chemo or whatever. And he had this like little clapper thing and everybody that was there started clapping. So then I just started dancing.
Nice.
Nice. Okay.
I love it. It's what you feel in the moment.
Yeah.
It's very cool. And so like, was there a big celebration afterwards? Was it just relief and recovery and trying to feel okay? Like, what was it like for you the last couple of days?
I felt like celebrating, and my mother-in-law, so sweet, she hosted like a little luncheon. So all the people I invited who had come to chemo with me came to our house, and we had little sandwiches, and, you know, a couple speeches were made, tears were shed. And sure. We just talked about this journey that all of these people have helped me and been with me on. And then I was like, okay, going to bed. See you later.
And, you know, something that really touched me as well is after you rang the bell and Olivia rang the bell and you were crying, Olivia was wiping your face, wiping your tears and stuff.
Yeah.
And how much of an influence has she been through all of this to you?
Right. I've told this to you guys. This three-year-old is comforting me. And it's just unbelievable how she's figured all of this out and how to say the right thing at the right time at her young, young age.
Yeah.
And how she's like, don't cry, mommy. It's going to be okay. Like, she's just been the best, which is why I do think she'll adapt when I have the surgery and
sure.
I can't pick her up. And that's going to be hard, too. But
yeah,
she'll figure it out.
No.
Yeah, she's on the journey too.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's the boo-boo.
Right.
It's the boo-boo. Uh-huh. That's right.
It's the boo-boo.
That's very cool.
And then she did this morning. She goes, when is the boo-boo going to be gone? Because I want to go to Disney World. And I'm like,
she has not forgotten that.
No.
Fair. I mean, fair point. Fair question to ask. She's a journalist in training is what that is.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Meanwhile, we're happy you're feeling okay. You're rejuvenated.
Yes.
Right. And now you rest for a little while before the next stage, the scans and the surgery down the road. But what do you plan on doing during this time?
This off time.
The best thing ever. I'm going to see the Backstreet Boys in Las Vegas at the Sphere.
Of course she is. Of course she is.
That's how I'm celebrating. You asked.
I thought she was going to be like, we're going to a beach somewhere and we're going to Backstreet Boys at the Sphere, no less. Yes. That's pretty good.
At the Sphere. I've been wanting to do that. They're coming back. And so I think that's a great way to celebrate.
Well, Backstreet's back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Backstreet's back.
And so is Jamie.
And so is Jamie.
And so is Jamie.
All right. We love you. It's good to talk with you.
Jane.
Congratulations on everything. We're so happy for you.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
All right.
We'll talk.
See ya.
All right. That's Jamie Edmonds. Getting to ring that bell.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Woo! Woo! Awesome.
Love it.
Awesome. That's going to do it for us. All talk coming your way next here on WJR. See ya.